Melbourne Writers Festival acknowledges the peoples of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which this event was recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation recorded live at our 2023 festival. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please consider making a donation to Melbourne Writers Festival. As a not-for-profit organisation, inspiring, thoughtful and challenging discussions like the one you are about to listen to are only made possible thanks to the generous support of people like you. Learn how you can be part of our community at mwf.com.au/support. I hope you enjoy this episode. This event was proudly supported by the John Button Fund, Melbourne School of Government and the Faculty of Arts, the University of Melbourne.
Good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of the Melbourne Writers Festival and the University of Melbourne, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to this year's John Button Oration. I'm Professor John Howe, and I'm the Director of the Melbourne School of Government at the University of Melbourne. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet and pay my respects to elders of the Wurundjeri and Bunurong peoples of the Kulin Nation. The Wurundjeri and Bunurong people have long held significant cultural gatherings on this land, and it is a great honour to be able to participate in a gathering that appropriately acknowledges the debt we owe to Indigenous forebears, Indigenous knowledge, and Indigenous futures in our city. The John Button Foundation was established in 2009 in memory of John Button, the late industry minister, senator, and writer. In 2016, the John Button Fund was transitioned to the University of Melbourne and has since been managed by the Melbourne School of Government. The fund enables the university to hold the annual John Button Oration in partnership with the festival. And I acknowledge that the Dean of the Faculty of Arts, Russell Goulburn, and the Provost of the University, Nicola Phillips, are here today. It's our privilege to continue the work of the Fund in honour of John Button's significant contribution to Australian politics and public debate. John was a Senator for Victoria between 1974 and 1993. On the election of the Hawke government in 1983, he became Industry Minister and Leader of the Government in the Senate, positions he held until 1993. As a minister, he oversaw substantial reform of Australian industry, enabling many industry sectors to succeed for the first time in the global marketplace. He wrote a great deal of journalism and three books on politics after his retirement, Flying the Kite, On the Loose, and a memoir, As It Happened. His 2002 quarterly essay on the Labor Party, Beyond Belief, won the 2003 Alfred Deakin Prize, one of the Victorian Premier's Literary Awards. In 1996, he became chairman of the Melbourne Writers Festival, a post he held for 5 years, and he was also a director of the Australian Book Review. I'd like to acknowledge that John's sons, James and Nick Button, are here with us today, along with their mother, Marge Button, James' wife, May Lamb, and Joan Grant, John's partner for the last 10 years or so of his life. And now to tonight's guest speaker. Sarah Churchwell is Professor in American Literature and Chair of Public Understanding of the Humanities at the School of Advanced Study, University of London. Her books include Careless People, Murder, Mayhem, and the Invention of the Great Gatsby, The Many Lives of Marilyn Monroe, Behold America, A History of America First and the American Dream, and The Wrath to Come, Gone with the Wind and the Lies America Tells. Her journalism has been widely published, including in the New York Review of Books, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, The Financial Times, and The Guardian. She frequently contributes to radio, television, and documentary film projects, and she has published many scholarly essays on The Great Gatsby. She was co-winner of the 2015 Eccles British Library Writers Award and longlisted for the Orwell Prize for Journalism in 2021. This evening, Sarah will be examining one of the most popular stories of all time, showing how histories of myth-making have informed America's racial and gender politics, the resurgence of white nationalism, the Black Lives Matter movement, the enduring power of the American dream, and the violence of Trumpism. Please join me in welcoming Professor Sarah Churchwell to deliver the 2023 John Button Oration.
Thank you, Professor Howe, for that kind introduction. And my thanks to the organizers of the Melbourne Writers' Festival for inviting me to join you all here down under. I'd also like to extend my thanks to the University of Melbourne and the Faculty of Arts and Humanities for their hospitality to me this week, and to the Button family for providing the occasion of this great honor. Thank you all very much. I will open in the spirit of reconciliation by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land, not only here in Australia, but in my home in the Americas, their connections to land and community, and pay my respects to elders past and present. The story I'm going to tell today has a great deal to do with histories and legacies of settler colonialism, and so it seems especially important to begin with this acknowledgement today. To all of you gathered here, thank you for coming on this rather wet and miserable day, although I think it's clearing up a little bit. I'm a student of literature and culture by trade, as you heard, which means I love a good idiom, so I thought I should start by saying good day. I'm an American who lives in London, and I'm very accustomed to having my accent mocked all of the time, so I thought I would do this in your idiom, but in my accent. Good day. I'm going to talk today about idioms of history, or rather, idiomatic history. And what happens when idiomatic history, by which I mean popular or oral or what we might call vernacular history, what we all think we know about our shared past, what happens when that becomes not just idiomatic, but axiomatic, even when it's demonstrably false, when we stop seeking truth and settle for truism? It's a story of history going in and myth coming out, a story of the power of fiction and how myth can shape the history going forward out of which it emerged. It is also a story with real violence in it, and I have one example that very briefly describes human brutality. So I want to ask first if there are any small children here. I mean, please do say if there is anyone who shouldn't hear this. It's very brief, and so I think it should be fine in that case, and it shouldn't be traumatic because it's brief enough, but I wouldn't say it in front of very small children. So I want to begin with a scene of violence that will, I think, be familiar to everyone here. Oh, sorry, I've meant to say. So this talk comes out of the research for my most recent book, The Wrath to Come, which is about the myth-making around Gone with the Wind. So that's really where it comes from. But I want to begin with this very familiar image. Many, if not all of you, will have seen this image over the last couple of years. On January 6, 2021, the Confederate battle flag of 1861 was carried by a mob of insurrectionists into the U.S. Capitol for the first time in American history. A treasonous flag representing the white supremacist side fighting a civil war to preserve race-based slavery, trying to defeat in battle the duly elected U.S. government, had finally achieved the purpose for which it was created 160 years later. It is an extraordinary photo, for the insurrectionist is strolling before the portraits of two Civil War figures. On the right, the passionate abolitionist Charles Sumner, who was nearly beaten to death on the floor of the U.S. Senate for his impassioned opposition to slavery, and the pro-slavery John C. Calhoun on the left, just under the Confederate flag, who called the peculiar institution of race-based slavery, quote, a positive good. I hold, he famously said, that in the present state of civilization, where two races of different origin and distinguished by color and other physical differences, as well as intellectual, are brought together, the relation now existing in the slaveholding states between the two is, instead of an evil, a good, a positive good. In the same speech, he added that the North's opposition to slavery meant future generations would be, quote, taught to hate the people and institutions of nearly one half of the Union, with a hatred more deadly than one hostile nation ever entertained toward another. It is easy to see the end. By the necessary course of events, we must become, finally, two peoples. Calhoun's speech was one of the legal and moral foundations for the decision of the South to secede. And therefore, although Calhoun died before the Civil War began, he was one of its most powerful and influential proponents. This image, as many observed at the time, powerfully encapsulated an explosively volatile history. What no one remarked upon that I saw was the surprising, some might even say astonishing, fact that this corner of the U.S. Capitol was inhabited by two such bitter foes in the first place. Why is John C. Calhoun, who helped make the case for the Confederacy to declare a treasonous war on the United States government, honored with a portrait inside that government's Capitol building? In reuniting the United States after Civil War, America had to reabsorb insurrectionists into its body politic. It had to honor the half of the country that had fought against it. And it had to normalize their insurrection, to reconcile the two bitterly opposed sides that had fought a brutal and bloody war. It did so by agreeing a tacit compromise. The country would abolish slavery, but maintain white supremacy. The white supremacism specifically symbolized by that flag, which was invented in 1861 to be carried into the Civil War by those fighting in defense of race-based slavery. In order to do all of that, a face-saving myth was created. This myth that the American Confederacy was a noble, lost cause, which fought to defend a gentle and benevolent civilization, created what the great African-American writer Ralph Ellison later called segregated memory in the United States. That segregated memory eventually led to the Black Lives Matter movement and political protests in 2020, and indeed fed into, although it didn't directly cause, the January 6th, 2021 insurrection. Although they lost the Civil War, the white Southerners of the Confederacy never conceded defeat, and they won the rhetorical war of ideas that succeeded the Civil War by lying about the reason they went to war and justifying their decision to enslave millions of people of African descent. As we all know, a great many of those who supported Trump in the election of 2020 are also still refusing to concede defeat. The current Republican majority in the House of Representatives is led by so-called election deniers. They call themselves the Freedom Caucus, who will still not admit that Trump, and therefore they, lost. So this is a story of two insurrections. For the Confederate battle flag being flown in this picture is also the symbol of the earlier insurrection that was the Civil War, which explicitly sought not only to defend racialized chattel slavery, but to expand it as the nation expanded westward. The history of the Civil War in America is not only the familiar story of North and South, it is also less familiarly a story of East and West. The conflicts that eventually ended American domestic slavery are inextricable from the forced displacement and genocide of indigenous peoples. For a nation that was, as Abraham Lincoln famously said, half slave and half free, the question of whether the new lands that were seized from indigenous peoples as the settler colonial movement rolled west, the question of whether those lands would join the slave half of the country or the free half of the country was an urgent one, so acute that that is what tipped the nation into civil war. And this is something that's really, really widely misunderstood, that it was really westward expansion that caused the Civil War. It was a proximate cause of the American Civil War. And that's why, for example, the skirmishes that began the Civil War were fought not where you might expect, where the Northeast and the Southeast meet on the East Coast of the country, but in the Midwest, in Kansas, in what was called Bloody Kansas, because they were fighting skirmishes over whether Iowa and Kansas would be free states or slave states. And that was why the so-called Free Soiler movement moved west to try to protect the new lands and insist that they would be free states and that they would not admit slavery or more slavery into the Union. When the South seceded and formed the Confederate States of America, they built into their Constitution not just a promise that slavery could never be made illegal in future, but also a mandate that it must expand westward, that new lands must continually be seized. So it was an explicitly expansionist and indeed militaristic project to expand slave-based government westward. As America tried to explain to itself the meanings of the 2021 insurrection, to articulate 160 years of history that it had deliberately buried, distorted, and erased, and the complexity of what I just described is just one tiny instance of a huge array of similarly complex facts that have been mythologized and wildly oversimplified. In order to try to explain images like this one, one story kept coming up in popular conversations as a shorthand to explain the worldview represented by this flag. And that story was Gone with the Wind. Gone with the Wind, first published in 1936 and filmed in 1939, is still, when adjusted for inflation, the most successful movie of all time and one of the most popular American stories of the 20th century. It won the Pulitzer Prize. It has been translated into at least 27 languages. It still sells around 250,000 to 300,000 copies a year. And its total sales exceed 30 million. It remains an iconic book, still regularly named as many people around the world, but particularly Americans' favorite books. And its famous valedictory line as Rhett Butler walks out the door on Scarlett O'Hara, "Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn," still tops the American Film Institute's list of most famous movie lines of all time. It is a story of the American Civil War and its aftermath, taking place from the start of war in 1861 to the reestablishment of white supremacism across the South in 1873. And it is also, as I'm going to suggest, a story of the 1930s that produced it and into which it emerged, a story of Jim Crow segregation at home, of the rise of European fascism abroad, and debates about the dangers of homegrown American fascism in the United States that were taking place during the 1930s. Like many Americans of my generation, I learned most of what I knew about the Civil War as a child from Gone with the Wind. It premiered on network television in 1977, when I was just old enough to watch it, and not just watch it, but be entranced by it, and not just be entranced by it, but become obsessed by it, and it soon became part of my imaginative world. It is a story of resilience and defiance, of survival and the importance of home. There is a lot to like about Scarlett O'Hara, the heroine of Gone with the Wind, and she's certainly a key reason why so many people have identified with the story. She's certainly why I identified so strongly with the story. She is America's first every woman, famously vowing that she'll never be hungry again, that no matter what it takes, she'll survive and protect the people she loves. Gone with the Wind is also an anti-war book. It absolutely despises the Civil War. It never glorifies the war. The flames in the background there are Atlanta burning. Gone with the Wind does not depict battles. It only shows soldiers when they are suffering at home or in hospitals after battle. It is a story about the consequences of war at home, the widespread devastation, and the grief for the women who, the grief of the women who have been left behind. And it is a story about an indomitable woman who will not accept defeat, who holds her tattered world together through sheer force of will and emerges triumphant until the very end when she loses what she wants most of all. Or does she? The legendary romance of Scarlett and Rhett, powered by the equally legendary performances of Vivian Leigh and Clark Gable, ends with Rhett walking out on Scarlett, as I've already said. Here's Rhett, "Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn." She's saying, "If you leave me, where shall I go? What shall I do?" And he says, "I don't give a damn," and walks out. But then she decides to go home to her plantation, to Tara, where she will start anew and devise a plan to get Rhett back. because tomorrow is another day. And in America, there is always hope for starting over. If you're white. Because Gone with the Wind is also the story of a plantation aristocracy that flatly refuses to accept the consequences of losing the war they started. It is a story about slaveholders who are enriched by chattel slavery, who go to war to defend chattel slavery, bitterly resent losing the war and losing their human property, and yet it pretends from start to finish that slavery doesn't matter. And it is a story of how vital it was to white American power to hang on to the land, one that romanticizes white people's ownership of the land, as you can see very clearly in this image. I mean, I guess you can't see that they're white, but trust me, they are. And it is certainly romanticizing their ownership of the rolling fields behind them. Scarlett's real romance is not with Ashley Wilkes, who she thinks she loves and loses, or with Rhett Butler, who she really loves and loses. It is with Tara, her plantation, which she really, really loves and keeps. Along with the enslaved workers who conveniently choose to stay after they are emancipated, in a story that refers repeatedly to them as willing slaves, which is what you call an oxymoron. The better class of African Americans, the story tells us, are those who, quote, scorn freedom. An African American newspaper rightly observed in 1937 that Gone with the Wind never represents slave labor, only the white wealth it created, while also treating violence against Black Americans as necessary for the creation of that wealth. Mitchell refuses to consider how wealth was gotten before the war. Not one example of the mistreatment of slaves is shown, not one example of a slave, proud and wise, who wanted to be free. Another Black journalist wrote after the film's premiere a few years later, "Gone with the Wind does such violence to American history that it practically lynches it." He wasn't wrong. Countering romantic myths with brutal facts will take us some way toward the truth. But part of what I want to suggest, and part of the reason why I undertook this study, is that fiction, by looking at Gone with the Wind, and I refer to it as a story so that I can talk about the novel and the film more or less simultaneously. The film is extremely faithful to the novel. There are a few important changes, which I'll kind of allude to, and we can talk about more in questions if you're interested. But basically, they are, in terms of story, they are the same story. Fiction captures something about myth that just looking at the history, just looking at the documentary facts, won't necessarily capture. And that is the desires that drove the creation of the myths in the first place. Where do the myths come from? Why do we want them? Why do we prefer them to the history? Obviously, they're easier, they're gratifying, but there are complicated fantasies and desires and emotions that drive the creation of these myths. And it's my contention that Gone with the Wind effectively captures them. And the more closely we look at Gone with the Wind, the more we understand both the origins and the purposes of these myths. This is the famous opening of the film, the prologue. There was a land of cavaliers and cotton fields called the Old South. Here in this pretty world, gallantry took its last bow. Here was the last ever to be seen of knights and their ladies fair, of master and slave. Look for it only in books, for it is no more than a dream remembered, a civilization gone with the wind. It's worth pausing and recalling again that this was made and became wildly popular in 1939. The film's producer, David O. Selznick, was Jewish, a first-generation immigrant whose parents were from what is now Lithuania. He was acutely aware of the persecution of the Jews under the Nazis, sending memos during film production about the similarities between the story of Gone with the Wind and what was happening in Europe to Jews under fascists. And yet, he still opens his film with a romantic, sentimental invocation of the good old days of human slavery. And this film, which opens with this nostalgia for human enslavement, continues to be invoked in American political debates today around the legacy of the Lost Cause view of history, the version of the Old South that Gone with the Wind endorses. Allusions to Gone with the Wind accompanied debates about Confederate monuments, the death toll from the violence of white supremacist mass shooters, and then eventually the Black Lives Matter protests after the murder of George Floyd in the summer of 2020, and as we've seen, the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6, 2021. Through all of this, people kept referring to Gone with the Wind to explain what was happening, or to express coded preferences, as Trump himself did when he complained about Parasite becoming the first South Korean film to win the Best Picture Oscar by asking for the return of movies like Gone with the Wind. Through all this noise and fury, it became ever clearer to me that Gone with the Wind was exactly the story we needed to think harder about, not despite its flaws, but because of them. Because they reveal so much more than we think about what we actively don't want to know about our own history. I want to be very explicit here and say that none of this means that I believe we should cancel Gone with the Wind or censor it or stop people from reading or watching it. Instead, I would like us to ask of Gone with the Wind harder questions about what we thought we knew. The myth of the lost cause represents a failed conversation about American history, and urging the erasure of Gone with the Wind would simply reinforce that failure. We can't just pretend it never existed, because that would help us reclaim our innocence. We could imagine that it was never really that bad, that surely in 1939 or in 2023, Americans were not actively engaged in nostalgia for the days of plantation slavery. But they were, and they are. The popularity of Gone with the Wind shows what white America has believed and wanted to believe about its own history for the last 80 years. It's about white America's great white myths about itself. But denial is never complete. It always leaves a trace. Gone with the Wind functions as white America's kind of guilty conscience, I think, with constant slips of the tongue betraying what it really believes, but won't admit even to itself. Those slips of the tongue point the way to far more difficult truths. And I'm going to give just a couple of examples so that you can see what I mean here, but a little bit more context to make sense of it. So as I said, Gone with the Wind spans 12 years, from the beginning of the Civil War in 1861 through the South's defeat in 1865, and then through what was known as Reconstruction, the attempt to reunite the country under the radical project to go from race-based slavery through emancipation to multiracial democracy in the space of about 5 years. Now, this is something that is really, really underestimated in histories and discussions about America. I think it's incredibly important, and it's one of the things that always gives me hope. This is a country so audacious, and you might think so naive, that it tried to go from race-based slavery to full multiracial government in like 5 years. And it didn't work, but I just love that it tried. It was hugely audacious. It was almost certainly bound to fail because the individuals who had literally gone to war to keep some humans enslaved were not going to meet those same humans the next day on friendly terms at the ballot box. It just wasn't going to happen. Efforts at multiracial government were met with brutal violence, including several local coups and insurrections, when elected multiracial representatives were thrown out of government. Several were murdered in cold blood. Hundreds and perhaps thousands of African Americans were killed, tortured, or intimidated when they tried to assert their voting rights. And in fact, Election Day for many decades was a moment of erupting violence, not just in the South, but particularly in the South, but around the U.S. And again, that's a story that American historiography has, until very recently, pretty much suppressed. And we certainly didn't tell the story about the coups in the Deep South, but they were there. Now they're, again, being resurfaced. Reconstruction, this effort to reunite the country under a multiracial democracy, failed because the white South would not relinquish power or its race-based social hierarchies. And so it rebuilt them in all but name in the system that became known as Jim Crow segregation. And because the North was tired of fighting and didn't really care, the majority of white people agreed that only slavery was wrong, not racism. They didn't have a problem with racism. They had a problem with slavery. And once that was abolished, they thought their job was done. So the country reunited over white people reclaiming power and denying, in practice, all of the rights that had legally been given to black people. That's how the nation reconciled. We chose unity over justice. We're good at telling the history of unity, but we're not good at telling the history of our divisions. And we have maintained unity at any cost, including justice, more than once. After the January 6th insurrection, we broadly made the same choice, or at least so far we have. There's an ongoing question about how that will turn out, but certainly many lawmakers, as you will have heard, emerged from that insurrection saying and still saying today that unity matters more than justice, and even blaming people for calling out injustice. The world is literally watching as I speak to see what happens to Trump and the multiple trials he now faces. And we are asking again whether justice might matter as much as unity, or even be the precondition for unity. For as insurrectionists stormed the US Capitol to overturn an election in 2021, observers were reminded of conflicts beyond the American Civil War. Democrat Jim McGovern, who briefly took over proceedings while Speaker Nancy Pelosi was spirited to safety, told reporters that the screaming rioters pounding on the windows were not protesters. It was, he said, basically homegrown fascism out of control. This would not have come as a surprise to some of the original audience of Gone with the Wind, who also recognized clear and frightening parallels between the Old South and rising European fascism in the late 1930s, and saw in Gone with the Wind a cover story for homegrown American fascism. "We are not," wrote the playwright Claire Booth in 1939, "perhaps sufficiently aware that Southernism is a particularly and highly matured form of fascism with which America has lived more or less peacefully for 75 years. Indeed, Southernism may possibly have been the inspiration or forerunner of fascism." That was in 1939. Gone with the Wind emerged into an active debate about American fascism that had been building since Mussolini took power in 1922, just as the second Ku Klux Klan rose again in America. The parallels were not lost on American observers, and for the next 20 years, critics warned that the Klan was American fascism, while many supporters of the Klan boasted of it. In May 1939, even as Americans read breathless reports about casting the film of Gone with the Wind, they could pick up a cover story in America's favorite magazine, the Saturday Evening Post, on America's star-spangled fascists, reporting that European fascism had its own authentic American forebears. Not only did current European fascist movements look very much like a streamlined revival of the Ku Klux Klan, they said, but their leaders were products of the Klan and readily admit their debt to it. One of those leaders was interviewed for the article. He was called George Dethridge, and he had resurrected the Knights of the White Camellia, another Reconstruction-era white supremacist group. The Klan wasn't the only one. It was only the most famous. Dethridge insisted to the interviewer that the Klan deserved credit as the world's first fascist group. "Thanks to the Klan," he said, "America started fascism long before Germany." He also saw the affinity between Nuremberg race laws and American white supremacists. "Nazi policy toward the Jews," Dethridge maintained, "is only a copy of the Klan's program for the Negroes." While, quote, this is Dethridge again, "even the Nazi salute is a straight steal from the Klan." Later historians would demonstrate how accurate this was, how much Hitler learned from American anti-black racism, up to and including basing the Nuremberg race laws on American laws of hypo-descent. David O. Selznick worried while making the film of Gone with the Wind that representing the Klan directly might serve as, quote, "an unintentional advertisement for intolerant societies in these fascist-ridden times." Elsewhere, he said, "I feel so keenly about what is happening to the Jews of the world that I cannot help but sympathize with the Negroes in their fears about material which they regard as insulting and damaging." But he didn't change the story. In early 1940, when the film had just been released, the black newspaper Chicago Defender published an editorial lambasting Gone with the Wind as, quote, "anti-Negro propaganda of the most vicious character, the voice of the lyncher coming from the screen, so that the lies and slanders of the landlord slave-owning, lynch-inciting South are being sold on a countrywide scale." The essay concluded with a warning. "At the throat of black America, Gone with the Wind is poised like a dagger. This is fascism." But white liberals were mostly blinded by their faith in an achieved American democracy to the realities of its white supremacist structures. and Gone with the Wind, with its Depression-era themes but historical setting, created a mechanism for disavowal, to pretend that this was all in the past, that white supremacism, too, was gone with the wind. But pretending doesn't work, not least because what really happened in the past has consequences in the present, even if you don't know what happened in the past. Ignorance doesn't change reality. It just confuses it. In 2020, Alabama elected a new senator. His name is Tommy Tuberville. His father fought in Europe during World War II, this is perfectly true, earning 5 Bronze Stars and a Purple Heart at the Battle of the Bulge during his service. Tuberville said when he was elected to the Senate that he was proud of his father's service record because he took part, quote, in liberating Paris from socialism and communism. He took office 2 years ago. This is a sitting U.S. senator. This enabled Tuberville to imply that he was engaged in the same effort to fight what he calls the doctrine of socialism in America and rewrite the battles of the Second World War as a battle not against fascism, but against socialism. The Cold War recast communism as the only ideological enemy the United States ever had. And as a consequence, we suppressed our own histories of Native American fascism, which definitely existed during the interwar period, partly because we never acknowledged that history. Truth is hard. It's complex. It's plural. It's slippery. It's contested. It's not static. It's not uniform. Truth is pluralist by its nature. It's not the same as fact, but it has a relationship to fact. And truth is much, much harder than lies. Lies are easy. We're all watching as democracies across the West are losing a good faith relationship to fact and the truth and diving into the cynicism of lies. And we can all see the dangers. Gone with the Wind is a story about white grievance. It demands identification with Scarlett's bitterness at her own loss of status and her willingness to blame everyone but herself. The novel of Gone with the Wind is far more explicitly racist than people who haven't read it probably assume. I'm going to give just a few ugly examples. Freed former slaves run wild, quote, like monkeys or small children after emancipation, quote, as creatures of small intelligence might naturally be expected to do. When Big Sam greets Scarlett, quote, his watermelon pink tongue lapped out, his whole body wriggled like a mastiff. Field hands have huge black paws and caper with delight. You'll notice that their cheerful enslavement is reinforced by these depictions, which conform to the trope of the devoted, happy slave. No one in Gone with the Wind is hurt by slavery, least of all the enslaved. And the profits of the plantation class are earned by their own labor. America's need to maintain the moral high ground is so profound that it ended up insisting that even its system of human enslavement was innocent. Terra is a plantation upon which enslaved people are never beaten, we are repeatedly told, and the women of Terra in particular would never dream of mistreating an enslaved person. But the novel keeps slipping up. It insists that the very idea of Southerners whipping slaves is vicious Yankee propaganda. But after her side has lost the war and their human property, Scarlett constantly fantasizes about whipping black people. And the heroes of the story do more than fantasize about it. Gentle, noble, blonde Ashley Wilkes, whom Scarlett idolizes and who she thinks she loves for most of the story, is, in the novel, the head of the Georgia Ku Klux Klan. This is explicit. This is not reading between the lines. He is absolutely and clearly the head of the Klan. When Scarlett is assaulted by a black baboon and nearly raped, Ashley leads a lynching party against the perpetrator and sets out to burn down Shantytown, where freed black people are living. And there is another example in one of the film's most famous scenes. So I thought I would look at this in a little bit more detail and then wrap us up. Anybody who's seen the film, how many of you have seen the film? Yeah, almost. So everybody remembers this scene. Scarlett makes a dress out of her mother's green velvet curtains and goes to visit Rhett in jail. And the scene has, of course, become iconic. But most people in my experience either don't know or don't remember why Rhett is in jail in the first place, partly because the film whitewashes it. The film says that the Yankees want his money, which he protected by sending to Liverpool as part of the Triangle Trade. And it says that they've just trumped up charges against me, but what they're really after is my money. The novel is rather more explicit. He's in jail this very minute for killing a Negro, and they may hang him. They haven't proved it yet, but somebody killed this darkie who had insulted a white woman, and the Yankees are very upset because so many uppity darkies have been killed recently. They can't prove it on Captain Butler, but they want to make an example of someone. It doesn't seem to bother the Yankees whether folks are guilty or not, so long as they can hang somebody. They are so upset about the Ku Klux Klan. Do you have the Klan down in the county? My dear, I'm sure you must, and Ashley just doesn't tell you girls anything about it. Klansmen aren't supposed to tell. They ride around at night dressed up like ghosts and call on carpetbaggers who steal money and Negroes who are uppity. Sometimes they just scare them and warn them to leave Atlanta, but when they don't behave, they whip them and sometimes they kill them and leave them where they'll be easily found with the Ku Klux card on them. This is truly an extraordinary thing for a novel in 1936 to say, and not just for some of the more obvious reasons. In the summer of 1936, you could read about Gone with the Wind and reports of the latest lynching on literally the same newspaper page. This one's from 1937. And on the right, they are reporting, it's a North Carolina paper, reporting the horrific lynching of Roosevelt Towns and Robert McDaniels, who were murdered in Mississippi by a white mob. This is 1937. After being tortured with a blowtorch, McDaniels was shot and Towns was burned alive. Two columns over, you could read a cheery little squib about people naming their children after characters in Gone with the Wind. In other words, the novel was influencing behavior, and the novel was telling its readers that white Southerners were the victims of arbitrary and retributive violence at the hands of Northerners and uncontrollable black people rather than the other way around. The lies are not random or arbitrary, in other words. It is a very specific projection, and it's a reversal of guilt. The people who weren't bothered whether folks were guilty or not, as long as they could hang somebody, were white Southerners in the 1930s who were killing black Americans in the summer of 1937 and 1936 and 1935 and on and on and on backwards through the beginning of Reconstruction and the emancipation of the enslaved. Rhett later admits that he did kill the black man. This is in the novel again. I'll frankly admit that I'm guilty as Cain. I did kill him. He was uppity to a lady, and what else could a Southern gentleman do? So it's a mandate. To be a Southern gentleman, you must be a white supremacist lyncher. Rhett Butler, the hero of the most popular American romance of the 20th century, is a lyncher. That's why he's in jail when Scarlett visits in her green velvet dress that everyone loves, because he lynched a black man. Gone with the Wind is also a story in which Abraham Lincoln is the bad guy. It hates Lincoln because he went to war to hold the Union together and emancipated enslaved people, and it creates sympathy for this worldview. Scarlett resents seeing the flag of the United States flying in Atlanta. She could have cried, the novel says, for once it had been a gay and beautiful place, and now there was a large United States flag floating over it. The heroes of the most popular American book of the 20th century are Americans who hate the United States. Scarlett's father, Gerald, dies rather than sign an oath of loyalty. That's why he gets drunk and jumps on his horse. In the film, they blur it in the film because they don't want to get into the fact that actually Gerald hates America. But that's actually, it's very clear in the, again, it's explicit in the novel. He won't sign the oath of loyalty to the United States. He gets drunk and breaks his neck. When Scarlett leaves the jail, having told Rhett she hopes he hangs, the episode comes full circle as Scarlett herself is subjected to the insolence of uppity darkies on the street, prompting her own vengeful, violent fantasies. The Negroes she passed turned insolent grins at her and laughed among themselves as she hurried by, slipping and sliding in the mud. How dared they laugh, the black apes? How dared they grin at her, Scarlett O'Hara of Tara? She'd like to have them all whipped until the blood ran down their backs. What devils the Yankees were to set them free, free to jeer at white people. So much for the very idea of whipping slaves being anathema at Tara. These are the people who, we are repeatedly told, would never dream of harming a black person. as long as they are safely enslaved. Once they were freed, all bets were off. Most defenses of Gone with the Wind begin with the strength and appeal of Scarlett's character and her battle of the sexes with Rhett, suggesting that while the story's racism is objectionable, it is of its time and, importantly, in the background. One of Mitchell's biographers accurately notes that race and politics and slavery are, quote, quite irrelevant to the perspective of Gone with the Wind, constituting no more than a backdrop for the real story, Scarlett O'Hara's struggle against the confines of Southern womanhood. But that's not a defense, it's the problem. Slavery as a social or economic system hardly exists in the novel, the biographer adds, which is neither quite true, Mitchell spends a lot of energy insisting on its benevolence, nor defensible in a novel about a civil war fought over slavery and its effects on the plantation class. It ought to be about slavery. It has to be about slavery. Gone with the Wind is a story about slaveholders and their grievances, asking us to share their resentments and celebrate their survival. It insists that slavery be still seen as America's peculiar institution, treating it as an anomaly, rather than, in the words of the great African-American historian W.E.B. Du Bois, the decision at the heart of the real plot of the American story, namely, to build a system of slavery into the middle of the world's first serious experiment in democracy. Our histories tend to discuss American slavery so impartially, Du Bois wrote, that in the end, nobody seems to have done wrong and everybody was right. Slavery appears to have been thrust upon unwilling, helpless America while the South was blameless in becoming its center. And we tell the story of civil rights with equal impartiality. When Hattie McDaniel won an Oscar for playing Mammy in Gone with the Wind, this is the Oscar ceremony in 1940, she was almost not invited into the all-white ceremony in Los Angeles. David Selznick had to pull strings to get her invited. And you almost certainly can't see her. But if I have it, let's see if I've got a little laser here or not. She is there at a table, right at the very, very bottom in the middle. Half of her face is there. And she's at a table with another African-American actor. And they're pushed far to the edge there at the bottom of the screen because they were at the edge of the room at a segregated table. She was not allowed to sit with the rest of the cast and crew of Gone with the Wind at the ceremony at which she became the first African-American to win an Academy Award. I'll give another example, which is more recent. This is a statue of the real head of the first Georgia Klan, General John B. Gordon. It was not Ashley Wilkes, who doesn't exist. It was General John B. Gordon. And this is a statue that still stands in Atlanta, at the corner of the Georgia State Capitol. I don't know if you can read that, if it's digitized, but the top left there, the street, the corner upon which that statue stands, is Martin Luther King Jr. Drive. Our culture likes to claim that fiction teaches us empathy. But when Scarlett O'Hara sees herself as the victim of black equality, when she bitterly resents having inflicted upon her all of the things she feels entitled to inflict upon black people, it does not teach her empathy. It makes her nurse her grievances. And those grievances are embedded in the landscape of the United States, as in many, many examples like this one. In denying the reality of the suffering around Scarlett and saying that only her survival matters, the story returns again and again to the idea that defeat is temporary, the future can be remade, that strength returns, and that nothing will hold you back. All of those are also a way of describing what we sometimes call the American dream. Universalizing this one woman's resilient response to adversity while insisting upon the importance of home as a source of renewal. From the sanctuary of home, Scarlett can rebuild from her ruins once more. But that home, Tara, that is so romanticized, was, as I said earlier, seized as part of westward expansion. The land was seized from indigenous people who were then forced westward in a ethnic cleansing. 60,000 people were forced from their lands in Georgia for the slaveholders like the O'Haras, who would then romanticize their deep and abiding attachment to the land when they'd actually only gotten it about a decade before the story starts. The real romance of Gone with the Wind is with the American success story. And if you remove from the novel proper names, characters, and simple descriptive verbs like said, looked, and knew, you can isolate the words that express the values across the novel's 1,037 pages. And as you can see here, some of the most repeated words are house and home, and another is money. The real romance of Gone with the Wind is with the American success story, the cost of upward social mobility. And in Scarlet, it offers a heroine whose devotion to the red earth of Terra means that everyone thinks Scarlet loves property more than anything else, which makes her return to Terra a happy ending. I began with reconciliation, and I want to end with it. As it happens, the idea of the American dream, to which I have been referring, was also invented in the 1930s. Many people think of it as being much older than that, but it was popularized in 1931 by a historian called James Truslow Adams. He was trying to make sense of the Great Depression and understand how America had gone wrong. And he said that America had gone wrong in losing sight of the American dream, which he said was not a dream of motor cars and high wages merely, but a dream of a social order in which each man and each woman shall be able to attain the fullest stature of which they are innately capable and be recognized by others for what they are, regardless of the fortuitous circumstances of birth or position. The American dream was about character, and it was opposed to nepotism and inherited privilege. A desire for personal wealth wasn't the solution to the American crisis, according to Adams. It was the problem. Adams ended his book with an image that I want to end with today. It is what he said was the perfect symbol of the American dream in action. The general reading room at the Library of Congress. And I love using this example because I would wager that nobody today would say that the symbol of the American dream is a public reading room at a library. But this is what the historian who coined and popularized the phrase said. This is his favorite example of the American dream. Mixed people, old and young, rich and poor, black and white, all reading at their own library provided by their own democracy. It has always seemed to me to be a perfect working out in a concrete example of the American dream. The means provided by the accumulated resources of the people themselves as part of the great democracy, devoting themselves to the good of the whole. Democracy, I'm not going to end with sales, for heaven's sake. He says, this is really important, democracy can never be saved and would not be worth saving unless it can save itself. The Library of Congress, however, has come straight from the heart of democracy as it has been taken to it. And I here use it as a symbol of what democracy can accomplish on its own behalf, founded and built by the people. It is for the people. So I'd like to conclude this talk at the Melbourne Writers Festival at the Victoria State Library as we gather to celebrate and reflect upon the importance of books and writing and thinking with this reminder of the foundational role that libraries play in democracy, and by extension, the foundational role in democracies of reading and writing and thinking about history and language and myth-making and politics and ethics and storytelling. We sometimes call these efforts the study of the humanities. We conserve such work in libraries, study it at schools and universities, and celebrate it at festivals like this one. Thank you for inviting me to share your important work in safeguarding all these vital endeavors, coming together to share and support the free circulation of ideas and our continuing efforts to get ever closer to collective truths. Thank you.
My name is Russell Goldman. I'm the Dean of the Arts Faculty at the University of Melbourne, and it gives me great pleasure to say a few words on your behalf, of a few words of thanks to Sarah Churchwell for her extraordinary lecture. Sarah started by wishing us a good day, and there followed an even better lecture, I'm sure you'll agree. Sarah started also by noting her accent as well. You may have noticed mine. I speak as a citizen of the UK. It's an interesting day today on which to be... You're ahead of me. This is a good audience. It's an interesting day on which to be reflecting on institutions that enabled and benefited from slavery. It's about 8:30 in the morning in London right now. Sarah told for us a story of two insurrections separated, in a sense, by 160 years, in another sense, not separated at all, and the story of the myth-making of Gone with the Wind and the work that that text, in its variety of forms, the work that that text does right up until our own day. Sarah offered us, I think, a compelling invitation, frankly, an invitation that we cannot, must not turn down, an invitation to attend to those things about our history that we'd prefer to forget. Sarah demonstrated before our eyes how to strip back the whitewashing of our history. That was a term that Sarah used in relation to the film as well, but the kind of whitewashing that is still perpetuated today. And I think Sarah demonstrated persuasively, finally, that we do have to give a damn, that we have to give a damn about our history, that we have to give a damn about working here and now to create a better society. So I end by noting that this is an interesting year in which to hear this John Button oration. As Sarah noted, there's a slide. Actually, I should move that slide forward. There we go. Let me end by noting that you can catch up with Sarah in the Hanson Hall to your left, where there will be book signings, and you will have a chance to thank her in person for the lecture. But for now, let's thank her collectively in the usual way.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers Festival, visit mwf.com.au/support.